Good afternoon. Welcome to The Birthmark, the podcast you can't wash off.
That's really awful.
Well, welcome back, everyone, after a bit of a summer hiatus here. So much to discuss and really thinking about what are the topics that we want to discuss since it's been a while since we did the podcast. But I think one of the topics that seems really in the news is Turkey. And everything that's happening in Turkey right now.
Right, which has been on the boil for a while. I mean, we could probably make some jokes about cooking turkey or basting turkey or roasting turkey. Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. So you have a fully paid up member of the NATO club, right? Longtime American ally. And we've decided to slap sanctions on them because of the way that they're treating a pastor. It's all a bit strange. There's no real rhyme nor reason for this, other than the fact it seems that President Trump wants to do this because he can do this. The economy is in bad shape. The reason the economy is in bad shape is because when America 10 years ago had a financial crisis, we cut interest rates to zero. So you can't make any money when interest rates are at zero. So it all went flying out into what we call the EMs, the emerging markets. And everybody's favorite emerging market was Turkey. So they get gobs of cheap money. And eventually, there's only so much real investment you can do. So you end up building hotels along the road to Anatolia that nobody will ever stay in and all the usual excesses that go with that. And now interest rates are rising. Here, all the money is going to go flying out. So the crisis hits the currency, it's depreciating, they're already in bad shape. There's in terrible internal governance. I think it's like the treasury is run by his son-in-law, you know, that sort of nepotistic signal to the market. Yeah. So it's not going well. And then at that point in time, you know, we go along and kick them. Now, regardless of whether there's warrant in the kicking or whatever, the danger is all the EMs are interconnected. So once you get Turkey going down, you get a contagion effect where investors get nervous about India, and then they get nervous about Bangladesh or whatever. Right. And you could then be looking at a serious problem, which is caused by nothing more than the president's desire to lash out.
But shouldn't Trump like Erdogan, given that he likes strong thug authoritarians? So is this just, I mean, this is a grudge that's not personality based, maybe even at least, which seems like most of Trump's grudges are like they don't like the other, he doesn't like the other person.
Maybe it's the fact that he's of a particular religious persuasion.
Oh, now that's an interesting twist.
It could also be if you've got the Russia conspiracy thing in mind, that, you know, this is actually an attempt to push them further into the Russian orbit, which would bespeak, you know, where is this influence coming from in the first place? And of course, like, it's hopelessly conspiratorial, so I don't want to go there. But nonetheless, you know, it's a pretty risky strategy to do, because you can end up causing a lot of damage to lots of other countries and ultimately the US itself.
Right. And like you said, the ripple and the pond effect of what then happens to India. I mean, big economies, though, too, not small ones. So keeping on this theme of bullies on the street. So I'm preparing to go to Cambodia with the students, and Cambodia had an election, big surprise, on late July.
And who won?
Drum roll, please. The general who's been there for the last 20 plus years. What was interesting to me as I watched this election, though, was in sort of the classic nepotistic theme that you were talking about. He created the general Hun Sen created these new parties, and what free media did cover this, they were called firefly parties because of course they burst and then they were gone. But it was an attempt by the general to make it seem as though this was a competition of some sort. I think they had 83% participation. He won with like 85% of the vote or something insane like that. But I think it was interesting sort of in the way that the election unfolded, but also that the current administration is not interested in what's happening in Asia almost at all. And so the Chinese influence has really seeped into that part of the world even more so. And in fact, the election watchers in Cambodia were from the long-held democratic countries of Myanmar and China. So those were the election watchers. No one from the U.S. or Norway or sort of the typical election watchers ended up going. So just another pattern of sort of thug strongmen continuing their hold on a particular country.
So when was this election?
Late July, I think the 29th.
But that's self-explanatory, right? So all the countries that hold clean elections in Europe that send election monitors, they all go on vacation at the end of July.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's like nobody's at work. So
what? You know, it's a good time to hold an election.
Good
then.
Time to hold an election.
Speaking of elections, thank you for that transition. Lots of special elections going on here in the United States as prep for the midterm.
Can you clean this up for me? Why do they call them special elections?
because they're off psych, they're off the calendar. So similar to Cambodia, they're held in the summer, they're held in the spring, they're held outside of that election, that second Tuesday in November model. And they're generally filling a seat, but a seat that's been open for, you know, 18 months, a year, depends on what the state says. And it's all dictated by the state federal election law or state election laws. So it's random. There's no set sort of model. Okay. But in any case, bottom line in these elections, it looks good for the Democrats. There's close races in areas that Trump won by double digits. And, you know, these returns, you know, you sit back and you think, okay, maybe the Democrats can flip the House. And then you think they're going to totally screw it up on Election Day. So,
well, more than screw it up on Election Day, there's a really interesting piece which I tweeted out when it came out, which from Tom Edsel in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And it was all about basically if you look at the preferences of Democratic voters, and particularly the ones that are active in primaries and all the rest of it, their preferences and hence their view of the world are really different from the majority of Americans.
Yep, yep.
So if we're sort of taking that as a bellwether or the indicator that the Democrats are going to do well because of this, well, you know, that's one very skewed part of the distribution. So it's going to be very interesting to see how much that maps onto. Because if Edsel's right about the distinctiveness of Democratic positions, and the same is also true for the Republicans, right? But because of gerrymandering, they're better able to internalize that. As you have pointed out before, the Democrats have to win, what is it, 18 million more votes or something?
Yeah, some insane number.
Because of the gerrymandering effect.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, they do have this issue that the preferences of the activists are very different from this so-called median voter. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, the rank and file voter. They're much less intense than the primary voters. I think that's totally right. So we continue on with our trade wars. I mean, this is one of the themes that has continued over the last three months.
Exactly, and will continue to continue over the next several forevers. So I've changed my thinking on this.
Oh,
actually, yeah.
Please tell.
So mainly because I've been reading a guy called Herman Schwartz who teaches in Virginia, and he didn't make this argument. I'm extrapolating from what he said. So for the longest time, I've always wondered why you would want to do this, because essentially we have this game that we play whereby we print these bits of paper called dollars, and then people give us real goods and services. And those dollars can't be used in their domestic banking system because it's the wrong currency. So they have to turn it into an asset. The easiest asset is basically buy a treasury bill. So they finance our debt and consumption, and we get real stuff. It's the best deal ever. And there's nothing else to buy, right? You don't know if the euro is going to be there in 5 years, whatever. So, you know, why would you screw this up? And Herman basically has the answer. And the answer is that if you look at the top 2,000 companies in the world that are involved in global stuff, right? 1,600 are American. And they're the ones.
1,600 out of 2,000.
2,000, right?
Okay.
And they're the ones that control all the extraction of all the value in global value chains. So, simple example of this. The iPhone in your pocket. If you've got an iPhone 10, which means you're a moron, you'll buy anything because it's flash. But imagine you've got one, right? So $50 of the value remains in China, despite the fact that it's all assembled and shipped from there. $400 goes to California. The rest of it goes to tax dodges in Ireland, right? But nonetheless, right, most of the value is captured by the corporations. Uh-huh. That's all dependent on what we call intellectual property rights.
Yep.
And what is it that China is stealing?
Intellectual property.
Absolutely. And basically, the only reason that you're able to play this long dollar strategy is because you believe that the dollar will be there in the future, but also because of what we call differential growth. American companies grow faster because they have control of these IPRs. So imagine that you don't have Trump. Imagine you just got a bog standard Republican president or even a Democrat. If you're not concerned about the fact that your IPRs and all the value chain is about to be blown up, and hence your corporates are not going to make the fantastic amounts of cash they are already, hence your stock market's not going to be nearly as buoyant, et cetera, then you're not paying attention. So it's not to say that he's justified in doing this, but essentially there are kind of pressures out there which are real things. And one of them that is part of the trade dispute is IPR theft.
Is China getting more aggressive and just being blatant about the IPR theft, or have they always been and it's just there's more stuff to take?
Well, I mean, they accuse us quite correctly of stunning hypocrisy. I mean, we're sitting here in Providence, right? Up the road, you got Pawtucket.
Yeah.
And you up there are the Slater Mill, which was intellectual property theft from Britain on a huge scale. In the 19th century, the United States didn't pay a single cent in royalties or copyright to anyone who was not an American-born subject. right? So we have done this. All yes. countries that develop do this, right? Asking China not to do this is just ridiculous. Of course they're going to do it. What you should be doing is accept it as a fact of life. Try and slow it, fair enough, right? It is theft. But then get ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
Use your technological advantage to get to the next step. And that would be basically massive investments in green tech and so on and so forth. But we don't believe in any of that stuff, so we don't do that. We're just going to sit on enormous cash piles and wash ourselves in money.
But it's also interesting because to get ahead of that, you'd have to invest in education at some level in order to create and encourage the future entrepreneurs of the world.
Well, future entrepreneurs, right. Scientists, engineers, right? Yeah, exactly. People who can do stuff,
yes.
right? And, you know, we're singularly not doing that. So in a sense, there's an itch that is there to be scratched, right?
Yeah.
But let's not pick it. Let's move past it. That would be the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
And of course, we won't do it.
That's right. Well, or in even to think about another wave of, oh my gosh, immigration to bring people that might be wanting to come to the U.S. to work, not even on work visas or something.
Again, but I said this in an interview recently, and I've changed my thinking on this as well, and, you know, call me a hypocrite for this one. So I benefited massively from the immigration system. Mm-hmm. I was born in Scotland, and I'm here and all the rest of it, right? And I benefit from what's called the H-1B.
Uh-huh.
And the H-1B is a very contentious thing, because essentially what it does is it gives corporates with tons of money a reason not to train their own workers.
Oh, because they can go abroad.
You can go abroad and steal someone else who's been trained at the expense of some other taxpayer who now gets no benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, if you're serious about development, you shouldn't be stealing the best and brightest from everybody else in the world.
Right, which is what post-1965 Immigration Act
totally
is scooping up all of
those
Indian scientists and engineers.
And it's been good to a point, and it's certainly helped me on an individual basis.
Yes.
But at the same time, if you think of the tech sector, what has it done? It means that corporates don't actually have to invest in American workers.
Yeah.
They don't have to invest in training. You can just get somebody else to do it and then steal it.
Well, and then we complain about how American high schools are terrible and, you know.
Right. Imagine if you, and this is, you know, again, this is one of the things that's up for grabs here, right? There's some data that shows this encourages serious wage dumping as well, because you're like artificially suppressing it by bringing people in who will work cheaper, particularly in the tech sector, right? So there's lots of reasons. If we're serious about sort of, you know, growth and dynamics and wage growth and all the rest of it, training has to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. And if you're not giving your companies any actual reason to bother with training, well, you're going to end up with unskilled workers who will be low paid.
Well, that's interesting about wage growth too. I mean, it's not just like suddenly you pay someone $10 more than what it used to be paying them. So this has been something that I've been thinking about since the beginning of the summer, and I had written down, and the sun then faded it over time, which was one of the rulings from the Supreme Court, and that was the travel ban, which was at the very, I think, one of the first big cases, one of the first big decisions that came out. And the Supreme Court supported the Trump administration's travel ban. They added Venezuela and one other country to it, so it wasn't a Muslim ban. And as
they're just the people we don't like ban.
Yeah, and right. With a sprinkle of one or two countries that, you know, that are randomly there. And I thought for the case to be, the case that was tried before the court was a bad case, because if we look at Supreme Court decisions in terms of presidential power, going back to the 1940s, there's only been like three or four cases in which the Supreme Court says curbs the power of the presidency in any way. And so there's a few out of the Bush administration having to do with waterboarding and torture. But otherwise, presidents have always had, from the court's perspective, free reign over this and presidential power. So when I saw this first, this case and then the decision, it wasn't surprising, because the court doesn't have any, they don't want to get involved in constitutional crisis. They're especially not interested in putting a thumb on the scale to say a president should or should not have powers. They're always going, or they have consistently leaned toward a president having pretty expansive powers. So I mean, this is one of the things to watch in the upcoming Ojoy Supreme Court nominee hearings, is whether or not what that person says. Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Gorsuch have all been on record saying that they support a strong presidential power. So it is certainly not a partisan issue. And so that's one of the things heading into the fall that I'm both cringing and waiting for, is the Supreme Court nominee hearing, because it's going to be, I mean, it'll be just a dog and pony show, but it's also.
Well, I mean, two thoughts on this. The first one is, you know, liberals in the United States are, you know, rightly freaked out about the court, right?
Yeah.
But I'll always like to remind them, you've only ever had one liberal court.
It's always been fundamentally a conservative institution.
So what's the shock value? Yes, there will be more restrictive decisions. We've got Roe v. Wade, et cetera, et cetera. The really interesting one is the whole question is whether the president can pardon himself, given an expanded powers remit. Yes. And there's an interesting one for Congress here, which is, okay, you might say that, you know, we're all embedded with Trump, we sink or swim, we're going to give the guy the right to pardon himself if anything comes out, blah, blah, blah. But he won't be president forever. And once you've done that, you've set a precedent that any president in future can do this.
Yes.
That's scary.
Yes. And well, and this speaks to the like Congress being a doormat to the president, but this has been forever. This is not just a Trump administration. This is a forever thing. So the president's setting is hugely important for the president. And I think, honestly, the court will say that the president can pardon himself. There's no precedents.
There's no precedence for presidents.
Yes, exactly.
So let's bridge to another topic.
Excellent segue.
So, albeit somewhat to a very bleak topic.
Yes.
So this big bloody bridge fell down in Italy.
Yes, and then I saw the footage of it, and then the
incredible,
the debris scattering.
But it reminded me of something. I think about a decade ago, the American Society of Engineers, or whatever they're called, basically said that 1/3 of the bridges in the United States were unsafe. Yeah. And we have done nothing about this. I mean, you know, remember, we're going to do all this infrastructure, right? And of course, Republicans won't spend money on anything, right? So, of course, this is still there. So you got to wonder, you know, when you're driving over the Tappan Zee or whatever it happens to be, you know, is this the next one that's going to go?
Yes.
Something else that's going on in Europe just now that's off the radar a bit is Greece is finally exiting its big bailout program in the end of the month. And
So Greek austerity is now completed?
They are going to be in debt until 2056 and they have to pay back essentially like 20% of GDP a year, and run a permanent budget surplus. I mean, like, good luck with that, right? Jeez. So, I mean, eventually they'll do some kind of debt relief deal, whatever, right? But, you know, the economy is much smaller. But anyway, here's the point I want to make. So Italy has been basically not spending money, right? And a bridge falls down. In Greece, the governing party was doing quite well, all things considered. And there was a series of wildfires and a lot of people got caught off and trapped and burned to death. And there was a great deal of question about, well, where the hell was the fire brigade? And a lot of people pointed out, well, you know, guess what? We fired them.
Seriously?
This is all your... Where do you think budget cuts go?
Right.
And I'm thinking, so I wonder if the Italians had to do away with the number of bridge inspectors.
Yes.
Right? You know, can you actually start to say, well, you know, here's some costs of austerity you didn't factor in.
Yeah.
Which is, let's close down some fire stations, okay, and then 40 people die in a wildfire.
Right.
Because there's no responders.
Right.
So, you know, I'm just wondering if the Italian story on this is going to, you know, implicate some kind of like, yeah, we should have repaired that, but we didn't because there was no budget.
Well, it's such an easy tagline to say, the bureaucrats, we need to cut government. And so, but that this equals firemen.
Yeah,
and yes, right, and exactly. Bridge inspectors and important people like that, and police people as well, as I transition to the 1 year anniversary of the Charlottesville rally.
Right.
They tried to gather, the KKK tried to organize themselves in D.C., and it ended up being tiny.
Yeah, apparently you can unite the right with two SUVs and a minivan.
Yeah.
I think it was like 20 people showed up.
They were united though, because it was a small number.
It was. So there was like 5,000 counter-protesters and like 20 people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is something I've always maintained. A lot of the sort of Strum and Drang, right, is a lot of people who spend their time, you know, on Reddit and 4chan, living in their basement, getting incredibly angry with the world. And what we got last year was, you know, this outpouring at this moment, a kind of unique moment where these forces were emboldened. But then someone died and it got real. And you had to own that. You had to own that politics of hate publicly. Mm-hmm. Stand up, take the mask off, own it. Very few people are willing to do that.
Well, and the take the mask off part, to actually reveal, like, this is who I am to friends and family. And, like, I'm not going to put on the literal mask.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one because, you know, on the one hand, you know, I'm a strict constitutionalist in terms of First Amendment protection, right?
Yeah.
You should be able to say whatever you want. You should be able to have whatever politics you want. A creeping politics of that's not acceptable is actually a very dangerous thing in a democracy.
Yeah.
But if you have a politics that you're not willing to own, that you're only going to have behind a mask, that's bullshit.
Yeah,
come on, call it for what it is.
Yes, you have to be able to stand. You have to be able to publicly show yourself. I agree. I agree with that. So I know that you're a big football fan, soccer fan.
I am.
I got on board with the World Cup just towards the very, very end. And I was struck by watching the championship game, the number of, I guess the semifinals as well, the number of players of color that were on all sides representing France, Belgium. So it was just interesting because I was thinking, who are the, like, what does the composition of Europe look like just in terms of the demographics? And then thinking about the elite athletes that represent these countries as well. And so for me, it was super exciting because I thought it was much more diverse than I would have thought.
So there were two sort of interesting political episodes stemming from the aftermath of the World Cup. So the first one was France won. And it was there was a French comedian who, I think he was a comedian, who tweeted out the names of the squad that won, right? Yeah. And then their countries of origin, even if they were born in France.
Yeah.
Right? So N'Golo Kanté suddenly became from the Congo or wherever he happens to not be from, right? So many of these people were born in France. Uh-huh. But they were all, you know, Africa won the World Cup was the tweet, right?
Okay.
And then Blaise Matuidi, who's one of the French players, took it and changed it all back to the French flag and just put one word, sorted.
Yeah.
Right? So there was a really interesting sort of politics there of like, don't choose my identity for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? If I want to be French, even if I come from Africa, I can be French. That's my choice. Right?
Yeah.
So there was a really interesting politics of that. The other one was Mesut Ozil, who was the German midfielder. Now, the interesting thing was he played crap, right?
Is he Turkish?
Yeah, he's German,
sorry,
right? This
sorry.
Is the thing. Yeah. He's like third generation, right? Yeah. His grandparents came from Turkey.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, he's as German as Lederhosen and Bratwurst, right?
Right.
He's just got a Turkish name and he comes from a ethnically Turkish family. So, essentially, he played like crap. Now, the thing is, he's been playing like crap for a long time. Best tweet of the World Cup I saw was after he played a particularly crap first game, and he's meant to be the main guy in the midfield that makes things happen. Someone tweeted, nice to see his taking his club for him to the World Cup. In other words, he was crap for his club, why would he spend it different?
Yeah.
Right? So he's not very good. But it really became ethnicised. And he resigned from the international squad afterwards and did this very long post that's worth reading and his reasons for it and basically accuses the Deutsche Football Bund of institutionalised racism and so on.
Yeah.
And there's a great line in it which he says, I'm a German when I win and I'm a Turk when I lose.
Yeah.
And it's really divided the sort of the German football establishment with some people saying, yeah, that's absolutely right. That's the way it is. And some people saying, nope, he's just making excuses for himself because he's crap, basically.
Right.
He had a bad thing. So just very interesting how the politics of this worked out in these two cases.
Well, and he's interesting too because, of course, that illustrates the tension between the Turks, those coming from Turkey to take low-skilled jobs in Germany, and the tension that exists between all of that stuff.
Right.
But that, I like that point that don't tell me where I come from, in quotes.
That's set of exchanges on that. And then just a little bit more on the Ozil thing, right? You know, the response to it, as I was saying, you know, has been very mixed, but a lot of players have like shown their support, etc. And it goes back to this whole notion of what do we mean by a national team in this moment, right? So it's a very complex thing. I mean, you're pointing out, you know, numbers of players of color outside of the distribution of the population.
Yeah.
A lot of them do come from first generation, etc., etc., some naturalized, etc.
Yeah.
And that whole notion of nations is like such a 19th century ethnic construct, the World Cup of Nations. And, you know, our own nations are not nations. Right?
Yeah,
they're polyglots.
Right. That's right. That's right.
So, you know, it's interesting.
Right, and the boundaries are so blurred. I love the picture of Putin congratulating France, standing in the rain, and then suddenly there's an umbrella holder over Putin to like, because he can't be rained on.
He cannot be rained on.
And I thought that imagery.
I would have
really
actually
funny.
Just expected the rain to like kind of part.
Right,
and
just
not
know
touch
naturally.
Him.
Yes.
No, actually not to touch him.
Yes.
That
yes.
would have been truly impressive.
So you were saying there was no crime, there was no petty crime.
Yeah,
as
so
a result.
This is another interesting one about it. So, of course, you know, Russia in the press here and Russia in Britain, you know, given the Skripal affair, of course, doesn't exactly have a good rep, right? And their football fans are basically hyper-violent paramilitarist thugs.
Right.
So when they go to, like, Italy for a Champions League match or whatever, people die, right? I mean, they're pretty serious, right?
Yeah.
So the worry was don't go to Russia, particularly if you're of colour or you're gay, because you'll die, right?
Right, you could
and
beat up.
Nobody got beat up. Like, nobody. It was spooky. I mean, just randomly, that many people in a big stadium, somebody's going to get...
Yeah.
No. Like, it was one of the most peaceful World Cups ever.
Yeah.
And yeah. I can't help but make the sort of the analogy back to the Rumble in the Jungle in 1974.
Right.
When Mobutu Sese Seko basically said to the criminal classes, one thing goes wrong, you're all done.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Putin basically got the heads of the ultras in these organizations for a nice little lunchtime chat.
Right.
Where he basically said, right, lads, you know the whole nationalist flag waving, beating the shit out of everyone? Yeah. Stops.
No,
you're not doing that. We need some good PR.
Right.
And it really paid off, because a lot of the Brits that were going back were like, this place is awesome.
Right.
Super friendly. Everybody's really nice. Whole thing. Why do we hate them so much? So it kind of worked.
I mean, I guess it shows that the big thug on the street, Putin, can really clamp down. I mean, this must have happened in Rio for the Olympics as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, they went in the favelas and basically like a lot of people were arrested, beat up, the whole thing, to make sure that there was no trouble for the rich people coming.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you, everybody. We will be back to talk more.